Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good morning, or I should say good afternoon, Rochester. You are listening to this edition of Soundbites. I am Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And we're going to have to play around with that a little bit, because we got some of the levels that are off a little bit, so bear with me as I kind of adjust this. Nick is, like they say, one step ahead of the law, so...
Somewhere in the Midwest. literally.
He's out running.
Yep.
So, yes, we're here, as usual, Saturdays, to take your computer questions, and the numbers are 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Or you can also text us, 585 209-9010 with your computer question, and we'll try to get it on. We more or less have a philosophy. The only dumb question is the one that you don't ask. Steve, I, and Nick have been doing this for over 23 years. Coming up, we got a birthday coming up soon.
Yeah. I'm trying to bring the page up real quick.
We'll be starting
22 years, 11 months, and 15 days.
We'll be starting our 24th year, or going into our 24th year.
Yeah.
It seems like a long time, but...
Seems like just yesterday.
We'll go into the... But you got a little news there?
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of SMSs, a major security flaw has been discovered in the Apple iPhone and in other cell phones that will allow people to, in essence, spoof SMS messages. According to the hacker known as Pod2G, there is a reply to number as part of a text or an SMS text message on phones that can be different than the from number. Let's see. So the reply to number that's displayed when a phone user receives a message can easily be manipulated to display a number other than the one sending the message. So using this simple procedure, the exploit, which can be used by malicious attackers to send messages that appear to be from a trusted source, say a bank, but any replies to the SMS would be routed to a different phone number. And this not only affects the iPhone, but almost all cell phones and smartphones. So the text payload section of a properly formatted text message, there's something called the UDH, the user data header. It's optional, but defines a lot of advanced features. Not all mobile phones are compatible with it, but many of them are. And one of these options is to change the reply to address. If the destination mobile phone is compatible with it, the receiver replies to the message. He goes to the reply address and not the sender address. So basically, this is very similar to the way the email reply address works, that your from address and the reply address don't have to be the same. So I can send a text message, say, from Citibank, and the reply is, you know, bad guys steal my account. And the text message can be, there's a problem in your account, you know, go to this link or call this number to respond with your password. And so basically they're tricking people into responding with personal information. It looks like it comes from Citibank or PayPal or some other trusted source, but the reply address is different. So when you reply to the message, it goes back to the bad guy. So that brings us to our poll of the week, that a serious flaw has been discovered in phones. The answers are, oh no, I better sell my iPhone immediately. Oh no, I hope there's a fix soon. Who cares? Android forever, until Google fixes the problem in Android phones. Mabel, can you connect me with Henry at the gas station? Ding. And if I click this button here, I can see that we have 29 people have voted so far. 59% are saying, Mabel, connect me to Henry at the gas station. 31% for Android. 10% say they hope there's a fix soon, and nobody is selling their iPhone immediately. And that brings up the little yellow box below the poll. We know that many of you can't just click a link. You have to give us your opinion as well. So if you click that the little yellow box, you can see the opinions. The first post, he's very psyched that he got first post. Every platform is subject to this imperfection, and it's good that it's being brought to the public, but we don't have to be as alarmist as saying get rid of your cell phone. Just be wary and be sure.
Due diligence
before you send a message back. In fact, so many people, auto-corrects and parentsshouldn'ttext.com. There's a bunch of text websites that will post crazy texts that people send to the wrong people all the time.
Do you do much texting, Steve?
I don't do hardly any texting at all. And in fact, I do so little texting, I don't have a text plan. So I basically tell people don't text me because I don't want to pay for your text. it's one of those weird things yet that you pay to receive a text.
Yeah, I really don't do much except maybe with some of the Apple free products.
Yeah, but we're seeing that more and more of the promotional people and social networking stuff has gone on to Facebook and Twitter now instead of using text. But you still see a lot of TV shows where you text this number and they'll text you back special news about the TV show and behind the scenes thing. In fact, I've even seen some really, really cool stuff with Shazam, which is a neat program for your smartphone that lets you the phone will listen to music playing. Mm-hmm. And then tell you the name and the artist of that song and then point you to wherever you can buy it. A lot of TV shows are using that now so that you can buy the soundtrack for the TV show. But instead of, in addition to just the music playing, Shazam knows dialogue and it will pick up what TV show and even what episode you're watching and then bring up information, you know, behind the scenes and background stuff about that TV show too.
That's amazing technology.
So it's pretty neat. And it's interesting to see what people are able to figure out how to do this type of stuff, which is really cool.
It's changing so much.
Yep.
Changing so much and so fast.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you don't text more. I mean, with me and my distributors, I mean, I do a lot of it. It's a lot easier for me instead of dialing, getting on the phone.
Well, we do most of that via email.
See, I just do if I'm looking for something in particular, I've got my one supplier that I can just directly text him. And say, hey, I'm looking for this, this, and this.
Well, now,
and then he'll get back to me, and then I can say, yeah, okay, go ahead, ship it.
Yeah. Now with Apple's iMessage program, you can send free text messages through the internet to all your between all your Apple devices. So we don't have to worry about actual text messaging using cellular text messages. We can use internet messaging a lot easier. And it's really neat how iMessage works. So if you have a computer, a phone, and a pad, you can start a conversation on one device
and pick it up on another,
finish it on a third. So if you're on the road, when a message comes in, it comes to your phone. And when you get home, you can go on your big computer with your big screen and your big keyboard and continue typing the same conversation.
Well, that works out.
Yeah. Pretty cool. All right. Shall we go to the phones now? And our first caller is Bill from Greece, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
Hi. I know you answered this before, but I forgot where I put it, so I can't find it. In Thunderbird, when I go to open my email, if I click once, I open it right away, and I don't want to do that. I want to make it two clicks before I can open it.
Oh, there's a Windows setting that changes the double-click property to single-click. I don't know if there's one in Thunderbird itself.
Yeah, I think it would be right in his regular control panel over the mouse, whether it's a one-click or a double-click.
Does that happen with other programs or icons on the desktop also?
I don't know.
Just Thunderbird.
It was working all right, or it took, because you say, you shouldn't open it until you find out what it's about.
Oh, okay, I understand now. You may not be opening the message. You probably have the preview pane turned on.
Yeah.
So yeah, you click it once and it shows you the preview. Mm-hmm. You need to turn off the preview pane in the Thunderbird preferences or one of the menus. I'm trying to launch my Thunderbird here to see which menu it's in. It's usually something like the view menu or a layout option to turn off the preview pane. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for pretty much every email program. You can turn off that preview pane. Mm-hmm. So when you click on a message, it doesn't open and view that message.
Right.
Which, even for spam and stuff that I don't want to see the spam, you know, I can I can click a whole bunch of things and delete them at once without previewing them.
Right. That's what I want.
Yep. Thunderbird is still launching. But it's in one of the Thunderbird menus somewhere. Let me actually try.
I looked and couldn't find it. Maybe it's because I didn't know what to call it.
It may be in the preferences, not the menu. We're rapidly trying to type and let it open and see what we can get here.
I can't help you.
Failed to connect the server. Let's see. Layout. It's in the view menu under the layout command. You can uncheck message pane.
Okay.
And I've got Thunderbird 3.0.8 installed, so hopefully it's the same in your version.
Yeah, I don't think they changed that part.
Yeah. They've also added in Thunderbird something called wide view, which is kind of nice. In traditional, what they call classic view, you've got your preview message at the top. The list of messages at the top and the preview at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But now that widescreen computers are so common, in the wide layout view, it shows you one column of a full screen height of your message, and then to the right of that, another column, which is the actual message itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see more of the message, and you can see more of the list of messages in that widescreen view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you fixed my problem. I just did it, and it works. So
all right, good.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, we're one for one so far.
All right.
Keep
Way
it
to
up.
Go.
Bye.
Thank you very much for calling.
That's for this year.
Hey, Steve, did you see how some clown ended up with Steve Jobs' iPad?
Yeah, there was a theft at Steve Jobs' house, which is... undergoing renovations, and so it's not being lived in. His wife and kids have moved elsewhere, and apparently someone broke into his house and stole up over $60,000 worth of computers and jewelry. And the idiot, there's probably no criminals listening to here to get the idea. The idiot used the stolen iPhone or iPad to log into his iTunes account from his home. So now Apple has his IP address. And in fact, there was an article in today's blogs where since it was $60,000 worth of equipment, it's considered grand larceny, and it's a lot easier to get the police involved than if just your single iPhone is stolen. So they were able to see that the iTunes account had been accessed from that IP address. So they sent police. So they got the home address of the person assigned to that IP address by AT&T's UVerse internet service. Went to the neighborhood to make sure there's no open Wi-Fi, because if it was an open Wi-Fi network, then it could have been anybody.
Yeah, he could have been sitting in the driveway.
Yep. They were all secured Wi-Fi networks, so it was someone living at that house or someone given the password by someone living at that house. And they also noticed that same iTunes account had been used by a different device at a different IP, and so they were able to track down the people he sold the stolen merchandise to. A couple of people, in fact, one of them was a clown, literally. They sold. He gave them the message or the iPad, saying he bought a new one and just gave the old one to the friend. And the friend didn't know anything about it being stolen. He didn't know it was Steve Jobs' house, and has since apologized, cooperated fully with the police, that he was just down on his luck and needed the money, and told the police where he gave everything away. So they've been able to recover just about everything as well.
But, you know, can you imagine giving an iPad to your friend and saying, oh, here's an iPad.
Yeah, what? How you know, is it? Stolen.
Really good for, I bought a new one, here, have the old one.
What kind of a friend is that?
A pretty good friend.
Yeah, but a 500, probably that's the top of the line being Steve Jobs.
Yeah, well, I bet he had one of each.
Yeah.
At least. They got several computers, a bunch of iPads, iPhones, diamond necklaces, diamond tennis bracelets.
But, you know, to turn around and, you know, be given over a $600 iPad.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, here, I got a newer
Especially
one.
Especially his friends probably know he's down in his luck and needing money. So where did you get all this money this fast? But there was a similar a stolen iPhone story. Apparently someone lost their iPhone on a cruise, and they think one of the cruise ship employees took it.
No.
Because pictures started showing up in their Facebook account. The person who owned the phone, the bad guy was taking pictures all over the cruise of himself and his girlfriend on the stolen phone, and the pictures were being uploaded.
Okay, tell you what, we still got, let's see, who was it? I think it's Bill on the line.
That was Bill. We've got Tim from Webster coming up.
Hang on a minute, he's coming up. But first, we got to hear from a few of our underwriters, and we will be back to the phones. And I've got another gentleman on the phone, so please stay tuned. And more sound bites coming up right here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Just got to get into it a little bit. Welcome back, folks, to this edition of Soundbites. And I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have Tim on the phone, so let's go to the phone. Hey, Tim, how you doing, sir?
Yes, hi, guys. Question about passwords for you. I know you covered it a little bit last week, too, but...
Never can cover it too much.
Yeah. I remember you guys saying probably about a year ago now, maybe or two, 17 caricatures is what stuck in my mind about supposedly unhackable passwords, and it just... Is there any way to expand upon it? It seems to me like, I don't know anything about hacking, but a good hacker or software program, what's the magic with the 17 caricatures?
Not so much a 17 caricatures as mixing it up. Instead of using all letters and all numbers, you know, like we've said before, or we talked about it just last week, using a phrase.
The GRC Haystack website, we mentioned grc.com/haystacks.
Well, you said lyrics were a good idea, too.
Yeah, I don't remember 17 being a magic number. Most places want to be at least 8, if not 10. And what we've discovered, Steve Gibson in his password security research, has discovered that longer is better than complex, that... We, you know, for quite a few years now, we've been told to use a complex, random series of uppercase, lowercase numbers and digits that you have no way of remembering. So you write it down, and that's worse. But long characters, so 15, 20 character passwords, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. As your password is very, very long, because there's two major types of password hacking. One is dictionary attacks. And so if your password is a dictionary word, it will be found relatively quickly because the bad guys just feed a dictionary into the password check, and they know if it's right or wrong.
And then along with a number sequence or
and so every time some passwords get hacked and released to the public, they say one of the most common passwords is 123456 or password or you know very you know password 123
1111111
yeah. So making your password two dictionary words will be quite a bit more secure because it doesn't fit a single dictionary word. So when the bad guys are checking your password, are trying to log into your account, they don't know how many, if any, of the letters are right. So, see, I still think the movies are doing this as a disinformation service for the police, that when you see somebody cracking a password in the movies, they crack it letter by letter.
Yeah, it can't.
They can't. Is the whole thing yes or is the whole thing no? So by having a longer password, a brute force attack tries A, and then AA, and then AB, and then AC. They try every single possible letter combination. Mm-hmm. They don't know if it's right. They don't know which characters are right. They just know if the whole thing is right.
It just seems like that dictionary approach would be an easy route to try to get to the hack.
It is.
Because these are... Now, I misspell my words.
Yeah, that's another way to do it. You could use a dictionary word if you misspelled it, and then it turns into brute force, trying every possible letter combination. But you want to use quite a few letters, you know, at least 8 to 10 letters, because then it's takes longer to guess. And if you mix uppercase and lowercase, you've got a bigger alphabet. If you put letters and numbers, you've got an even bigger alphabet. If you use a special symbol, you know, like a period or a pound sign, you have even more characters. So the GRC Haystack page has got an interesting little calculator that you type in a password, and it tells you how long it would theoretically take to crack based on a brute force calculation.
And what just occurred to me is, you know, some sites have, like, the CAPTCHA stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, are there some sites where software or machine could just be put into place and just try over and over and over again? That doesn't really even exist anymore, does it?
Well, generally, yes, but most websites will stop you after 3 or 4 wrong guesses.
Right.
So the offline attack is getting to be much more common. So if I'll record as a bad guy, I'll record a bunch of traffic at PayPal, for example, and then I'll take it offline. It's all encrypted. I have no idea what it says, but then I'll do my offline brute force attack. And some of the offline attacks, there are purpose-built password cracking computers that have been built that can guess 100 billion guesses per second, and that's what Steve Gibson calls his fast attack scenario: 100 billion guesses per second.
That was what I was thinking. I thought surely that technology must exist to do that much.
Yep, and oftentimes it's graphics cards. You put a bunch of graphics cards together. Typical graphics card might have 80 to 100 processor cores in it to display graphics really fast.
So you have your own supercomputer.
Right, so it's in essence, it can be its own supercomputer. So like the password, you know, all lowercase password, there's 26 characters in the alphabet it's using.
Right.
It's an 8-character password, so you might think that's okay. But it can be guessed instantly because it's a dictionary word. So for a long time, one of the suggestions was, you know, instead of an O, put a 0 in. And so that would take longer to crack. But the bad guys know we're doing that. So now that's part of their dictionaries, is using O's instead zeros instead of O's and I's instead of L's.
Exclamation marks.
Yep.
But one of the other things, though, that Nick was saying before, like last week's, and going back to that, is pick a phrase. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A favorite movie, a favorite quote, something like that.
And use the first letter of
each word.
Each one, and throw in some numbers.
Yep. And we've also... A good password practice is to never use the same password on different sites. But people have a hard time remembering their passwords. So use the site as part of your password. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Amazon. 4 score and 7 years ago, PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps you remember what password you used for what site.
Even though this is essentially using dictionary words.
It's multiple dictionary words.
Yes.
So
it's not just one word. It's a phrase. You're only taking the first letter of that particular phrase.
Or even using the entire word. There are so many letters in the word, but you don't want it. You may not want it to be, you know, a famous quote.
Right.
Because part of the dictionary word could be like Bartlett's familiar quotes.
Yeah,
they could feed that in.
Use a quote of your own.
Yeah.
If you're famous for saying, you know, bluebirds or
a catchphrase that you use a lot, you know, what I mean,
like to build their nests in high trees or something, you know.
Yeah.
What is this offline thing you had mentioned a minute ago?
It's two ways of attacking is someone goes to paypal.com, types in your email address, which is very easy to get for people. Or even just random email addresses, you know, Steve at Roadrunner. There's probably a Steve at Roadrunner. It's not me. Some bastard got it before I did. But they'll try every possible, and that's how a lot of spam works. They just send mail to every letter combination at the known internet provider. So go to paypal.com, username Steve at Roadrunner, and then type in a password as password. And then PayPal says no. And then, so second try, password 123456, and PayPal says no. So that's an online attack. You're online on the internet doing a live attack. Most websites will stop that after 3 or 4 wrong tries and say, you know, did you forget your password? The offline attack is where the bad guys capture data. You have a router and all of the internet traffic will go through an internet router. So usually this is someone inside an ISP, but doesn't have to be. They capture all the data, and they can find PayPal.com because that's unencrypted. Because when you type a web address, it's unencrypted. But then the blob of encrypted data after that is someone's username and password login. So then with an offline attack, you take that data and run it through your own computer in your own secret basement lair and try to decrypt that data by guessing random passwords.
How can that be protected against?
By having a long password. So if it would take, you know, so my example, best of times, worst of times, would take 1.6 trillion centuries to guess.
Really?
Yeah, because there's 23 characters in that password.
Well, that's given current technology. Well, that doesn't say anything about quantum-based computers we're working on, right?
On the password haystack, they have a current fast attack scenario is 100 billion guesses per second, and it would take over a trillion centuries. He has the next extrapolation is the massive cracking scenario, 100 trillion guesses per second, and that would only take a billion centuries to break.
Okay. Pocket change. I feel better now.
Yeah, the math involved in quantum, the quantum leap or quantum generational number of guesses. It lowers it from a trillion centuries to a billion centuries, which is a significant reduction in strength, but it's still so far beyond anything we can possibly do that it's...
Forget it.
Forget it, yeah.
Okay.
Although, ironically, it could guess right the first try.
Right.
This is true.
So does that kind of help you out then?
Yeah. So, you want to use a long password. Long is better than complex, we've been finding.
Okay, so then lastly, first of all, it sounds like the offline attack is probably going to be the preferred route for most, the way to go about it for most hackers.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then secondly, why doesn't PayPal do something like three attempts and they call you?
Well, they don't have the staff to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Millions of people a day. But what they, three attempts and they say you forgot your password and we'll have to go through an extra step. And a lot of places that use CAPTCHAs, we've been finding that CAPTCHAs are virtually worthless.
Yeah, right.
Because the bad guys will take the CAPTCHA picture. The picture. Yeah. So it's a picture of letters that half the time you can't read anyway. And they've created games we've been hearing about. There's one that does strip poker
that requires people to actually solve what the captcha is.
Right. Some guy in some third world country makes a penny a captcha for every captcha he types in, and it makes the girl strip to give him an extra incentive. And then now the bad guys have the captcha. So what a lot of places are doing, and this goes along with the hack we talked about last week. With Matt Honan from Wired Magazine, is two-factor authentication. So Google implements this now, and anyone with a Google account should probably turn it on, that you type in your username, you type in your password, and then Google sends you a text message, we're back to the texting again, with a second code that you then have to type in immediately. That code lasts like 30 seconds or something. So we talk about this multi-factor, something your password, something you have, your cell phone, so that you need both of those pieces of information to log into the account.
Kind of Craigslist does something sort of like that with their phone authentication thing.
Yeah. Several bigger websites have started doing this second factor authentication. A lot of banks are doing it. PayPal has their security token, so they can have a second authentication. It's a little credit card looking device where you push the button and it displays a number. You have to put that number into your login screen as well. Although RSA, which is one of the big companies that does this security stuff, they were hacked last year, and anyone using an RSA security token was vulnerable. And it was a spear phishing attack. Somebody got an email at RSA, RSA.com. Here's the new employee benefits package. And they opened it. Mm. And it put a keystroke logger on their computer inside of RSA.
Terrible.
Which then was able to get the master password for all of RSA's security passwords they passed out. So RSA had to replace every single of their millions of security pass dongle fobs that they had sold to all their big customers. So The second factor isn't foolproof, but it's better than only one factor authentication.
I've heard that there's software now that can read these CAPTCHA codes, and that maybe it would be better. Yeah. Wouldn't it be better to have a puzzle in there, like 2 + 4 =
There are some websites that even do that. You have to do a math program.
Well, right, but that's probably much less hackable.
For now, until it gets better. In fact, there was who was it? There was a blog I was reading, and someone had encrypted data captured from 10 years ago when it was impossible to break with 10-year-old computers, and now they were able to break it in only 26 computer years of processing. So 26 computers for a year or 52 computers for half a year, they were able to break 10-year-old encryption standards, which is why you may be seeing a lot of encryption stuff online going to 2048-bit or 4096-bit encryption.
4096.
Because this was a 512-bit encryption key that has been weakened, not actually cracked, but weakened. So everyone now is jumping to 2048 or 4096, which should be safe for another 20 years or so.
Okay, so does that solve it for you?
Yes, it does. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, so it's an interesting topic that is it secure now and will it be secure in the future? And the other thing that I see in a lot of TV shows, I can break that encryption in 10 minutes.
Yeah, no.
Modern encryption cannot be broken yet, but you can guess the password, and that's how the bad guys and even the good guys now are breaking into accounts.
But of course, with the limited number of attempts, and you shut everything down, there's no way.
That's why the offline. In fact, the iPhone iOS has an interesting thing in it. When you type the password wrong too many times, it locks you out for a minute. And then you type it wrong again, it locks you out for 2 minutes. Yeah. You type it wrong again, it locks you out for 10 minutes. Eventually, it locks you out for trillions of minutes.
Yes.
Alrighty, that music tells us that we're running out of time and in this area.
Yeah, we've got to hear from a few of our underwriters, but we've got Victor on the phones, and we got a couple other folks still holding, so we ask you to just please hold on. And after these few great words of wisdom, pick up the phones. We still got a couple other lines open. Love to take your computer questions right here at member-supported Jazz 90.1. And welcome back to this edition of Soundbites, August 17th.
18th.
18th?
Saturday, August 18th.
I lost a day. Well, I was on vacation last week, so I think my mind still is. Yeah, went away and had some great weather. Can't complain one bit. But tell you what, let's go to the phones because we had Vic on the line. Go ahead, Vic, from Irondequoit.
Hi, guys. I'm probably one of the last 5 people left in the world that doesn't have a data plan on their cell phone. That being said, every now and then, I would like to send a text message to somebody. And I went to a bunch of sites on the computer, and I found one I've been using for the last several months that's great. I don't get any spam. Doesn't cost a penny. I'd like to share it with you guys if you'd like.
Sure.
It's txt2day.com. It's great, very simple. Even a moron like me could use it. And, again, I've been using it for the last couple of months. And every now and then, again, I want to send a message, but I don't want to pay for the texting. So
yep.
I just thought I'd share it with you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Alrighty, thank you very much.
A lot of the cell phone companies will do texting with no plan. It's like 25 cents per text message. Or they have a plan, usually like $20-$30 for unlimited messaging. They used to have a lot of intermediate plans, 100 messages a month or 200 messages a month. But so many people are now using the internet to send email and to send messages through the internet that they're not using text messaging, so they've cut down on a lot of those other plans. But there's quite a few internet to text messaging services. Most of the cell companies have them themselves. So if you're a Verizon customer, you can go to VZW.com, Verizon's own website, and send a text message to another Verizon customer. But this is a nice one, text today. I can't get to it here at the school because it's blocked.
It's blocked. Yeah, I just noticed that.
Shouldn't be texting at school.
Right.
Yep.
But thanks, Victor.
It works. It's not texting.
All righty, let's go to Ray in Rochester. How are you doing today, Ray?
Good. How are you?
All righty.
I'm trying to do a tech support for my daughter, who's like about 1,700 miles away, and she called me and asked how she goes about changing the IP address on their Linksys wireless router that's in the house. And she was telling me she's got like a Apple laptop, and she was getting this message that someone was trying to access her computer.
Well, the message is wrong.
Okay.
Routers generally have two addresses. They have the address that the internet service provider gives you, and that you cannot change. They change it at their end.
Okay.
And that's called the public IP address.
Right.
And then you have the private network IP address, which is assigned by the router to your network. With the Linksys routers and pretty much every router, there's a web server built into the router, and you type the address of the router into your browser, and that lets you configure the router settings. Most of the routers are 192.168.1.1.
Mm-hmm.
So you type that into your browser, and that will let you into the router login page. Now, you're going to need to find the instruction sheet that came with the router to get the password for the router. Although, if you didn't change the password, the default passwords for all the routers are well publicized on the internet, and that's how a lot of people break into routers because the password was never changed.
Yeah, they never changed that, nor the security for it.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's changed. If someone was trying to break into the computer, it was most likely through the Wi-Fi. Otherwise, they'd have to have a physical Ethernet wire plugged in to the network. So she may want to change the Wi-Fi password if it happens to be a wireless router as well.
Okay. I was trying to understand exactly what she was trying to tell me, and I thought she wouldn't be able to really do much in changing that. And I, you know, was trying to look up information on how to tell her, and of course,
yeah.
I said, if you go do that, you're going to affect everyone else in that house that's using that router.
Right. The computers themselves typically use what's called dynamic addressing. So they ask the router to give them an address.
Okay.
So if you change the address of the router, every computer will get a new address from the router. So you could change that 192.168.1.1, which is usually the default address for routers, change that to something like 192.168.50.1.
Okay.
And now your network inside your house has a different IP range.
Okay.
But that wouldn't change the address outside your house because that's controlled by your ISP.
Yeah, you don't have any control over that.
So then really there's nothing she can really do.
Change the security, yes.
Change the password on the router is the best thing to do.
Yeah, and make sure that the Wi-Fi is set up with security, that it's not wide open.
Right.
That I couldn't come over to her house, sit out front in her driveway, and it says, oh, it's an open network, and sit there and start downloading stuff and get her in trouble.
Yep.
Well, I do know that when I was visiting down there, I had to put some kind of a long, lengthy number to access their network.
Okay, that's good.
So,
that's
so
a good sign.
There was a password on there, so
yeah, she might want to change that. If too many people know it, then someone could be sitting in her driveway trying to break into her computer.
Yeah, if it's a generic one.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I'll see if she can do that.
The other thing though you can do to help her out is you can always put on her machine and yours is log me in.
Yeah, there are several remote assistance programs, commercial companies and free ones. Logmein.com is a nice one because they have a free personal use version. So then you can log into her computer remotely. So you're at your home, she's at hers, it's, 1,700 miles away. You log into her computer as if you were sitting in front of it and can make all the changes as if you were sitting at her computer.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, that can be dangerous because the bad guys can do the same thing. We have seen quite a few examples because a lot of the big PC companies do this too. They'll log into your computer and fix problems on your computer. Make sure you log them out when you're done, because we've seen cases of unscrupulous tech people will stay logged in and watch you go to your bank and watch you go to Amazon and then steal your credentials that way, too.
Yep.
Okay, so in other words, this message that she claims she got about someone trying to access her computer is sort of bogus?
Probably. It's probably what we call
it. She's got a Mac.
Yeah, it's a phish, and it's if she's got a Mac. Yeah, it's a phishing attack. She gets an email saying someone's trying to break into your computer, you should, go to this website and do these things. And it will probably ask for credit card or password of some sort.
Yeah, purchase a software to
steal her information,
Okay.
I got a kick out of the ones that were going around last year from the FBI purportedly. You get a message from the FBI saying, we've detected illegal computer access, and we've logged your IP, and we'll be by to arrest you shortly.
Yeah.
They're not going to warn you when they're coming to arrest
That's
you.
That's right.
Yeah. They'll show up on
Gee,
your doorstep.
I'm going on vacation that week.
Yeah.
All right, so that help you out?
Yep, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome, sir.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Steve. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we can't stress enough. You got to actually look at some of these emails and that you get. And just don't go clicking, because that's what's getting a lot of people in trouble.
And a lot of times you can tell the fake emails because there's bad grammar, there's misspellings, but they get sneaky. You know, we talk about PayPal and Citibank a lot because those are such big targets. But it instead of PAYPAL, it could be PAYPA1. And if you don't look close enough, it looks like PayPal, so you click the link.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's a fraudulent website, and suddenly you're going to a bad website. You think you're at PayPal, so you log in with your PayPal username and password. Now, the bad guys have that. They can log into your account and spend all your PayPal money.
So always, always go to the website itself,
right.
Yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you get an email of any that you think might be real, you know, something with your bank, open your browser, type the bank address yourself.
Yeah,
never click on a link in the email. All right, next on the line, we've got Larry from Rochester. How are you doing today, Larry?
Excellent, especially since the heat broke.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a welcome relief.
Anyway, back onto that password thing real quick. I ran into one recently that I had not seen before. That doesn't mean it didn't exist before, but when I set up my online banking with a new bank back in around May or so, they have, when you set it up, you have to enter a phrase of, you know, you're choosing letters, numbers, whatever it may be, you know. And then they have a whole bunch of images, you know, like a picture of a tree or a fish or whatever, and you have to choose one of those two. So now when you go to log in, you enter your username, and then it takes you to what they call their credentials authentication page. And if you don't see both of those things correctly, then there's a link to click here. Actually, I don't even know what that link does. But if they're correct, the picture and your phrase, then you can enter your password.
Yeah, that's... Now, it's,
it would seem to me that the a graphics image, somebody's, you know, capturing data with a... I forgot what you used to call them. Anyway, whatever they're doing, would be awful hard to reconstruct that picture.
Yeah, that's sort of why they were using CAPTCHAs, which is a picture of text scrambled up, but people have a hard time reading that text. So, an actual picture of an animal or flower or something like that, that's an interesting way to do it. Pattern recognition, which that's called, has been a very hard thing for computers to learn. Detecting faces was one of the big breakthroughs in pattern recognition. So a lot of cameras now and photo software has face detection in it. So it can detect the face in a picture. So we're starting to see computers learning that type of stuff. So if you know, your word is fish and it shows a picture of a flower, you know that's wrong. So it's interesting to see how they're expanding their second factor authentication to try to beat the bad guys.
Yeah, I really like the picture idea.
A lot of places have used passphrases or, you know, what's your mother's maiden name kind of phrases as authentication.
Your first pet.
The problem there is a lot of that information is well known and accessible on the internet. So one of Nick's suggestions is always lie. You know, what's your favorite color? Florida. And and then
it doesn't care.
Yeah, it That's doesn't true. Know. It yeah, it know. Just it just compares the question and the answer, so that you don't have to worry about, because that was a big thing with what happened with Sarah Palin in the last election. Someone broke into her email account because her secret question was, where did I meet my husband?
Right.
So
I believe reading on the first try.
Yeah, look up her biography.
Boom, you're in.
Yep. So you having that second factor, you know, it's not quite a second factor, because your password is something you know, and then this picture is something else you know. It's better than nothing, but it's not quite a second factor.
Just because a phrase, you know, what's your first pet's name or favorite pet, you know, you could have said Ford.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it doesn't care because it doesn't know whether that's a right answer or a wrong answer. Put in whatever obscure thing you yep. want to do, so it's harder for them to even try to correct it. You know, yeah. crack yep. it.
Harder put for the bad guys to get in.
And you yep. put in the name of the brand of the car you're driving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Whiskey Sour, or, you know, I mean,
okay,
you don't cool. have to, computers only know ones and zeros.
Yep. What right. what bank was this, if I may ask?
I'm sorry?
What bank was it that was doing the picture?
First Niagara.
They're doing real big here, coming into Rochester and doing
yeah,
a lot of advertising.
Over
yeah,
just about all the HSBC branches
yep.
in many areas, because HSBC's wants to, you know, get out of or very much
yeah.
they're
gone.
Retail banking and just become a money center bank.
Yep. But yeah, so that's pretty neat that they're thinking about that and learning from that way.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's all I wanted to throw in. I just thought it would be
yeah,
you know,
thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Level thing that would be very, very hard to decrypt a picture.
Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right.
All right. Well, you have
thanks
a good
for
one.
Calling.
Thanks for calling.
Yep. Have a good one. Bye.
You too.
Yeah, so it's the they actually have on their website a lot of this security information. They will never send a text message. So if you get a text message claiming to be from First Niagara Bank, it's false. So that's created a problem now that banks like Citibank and SunTrust, which is big in Florida, because all the older people down there, they can't send out email. Because no one would believe the legitimate email, because there's been so much spam and fake email that
right.
they can't do it anymore. So it's frustrating, and that brings back what an earlier caller had said about why don't they just call you? You know, they might have to start staffing up again to have more people on
that's
the phones.
That's right, they would.
All right, I already warned Tim that you know we'll have him on and get his question, and this is Tim from Rochester to get his question in and then. Before we head up for the break, but we got about a minute. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I've got a question about Google Groups. The church that I belong to has a volunteer group that they recently went to Google Groups to administer both the schedule and to establish a DL for communication. And it was this was about a month ago. It was in existence for about a week. And someone sent out an email to the group, and one of the members of the group had an automated out-of-office
yep.
message. And so it created a mail storm. I think wound up with something like 350 messages that I had. Everyone wound up with 350 to 400 messages, out-of-office replies.
Which then gets sent to the group, which then the group echoes to everybody else. And
the next round of remove me from this DL. I suggested to the administrator of the group that she tell everyone they're sending to the DL to put the DL in blind copy and send direct them and put themselves as the recipient. She suggested that, and when I got that message, I could actually see the DL in the blind copy, which kind of defeats the purpose of blind copy. Is there any way to
hey, Tim, all right, Tim, tell you what. Like I told you, we're going to have to take you for... Just hold on. We'll have you back on as soon as we come back for this heartbreak at the top of the hour that I have to do. But you are listening to member-supported Jazz 90.1 Soundbites here on Jazz 90.1.
Compute Running Computer Show. Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon to this edition of Soundbites, August 18th. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have Tim on the phone. Let's go ahead and continue on with Tim's Google Groups.
Yeah, Google Groups is what's left of Usenet, and it's basically slowly dying. I'm digging around here to try to see if there's a preference you can set in that. You may be. How many people are on this distribution list?
I'm not sure. I'm not the administrator, but I think it's like between 50 and 100.
Yeah. Most internet service providers offer their own mailing list options. So you would have a mailing list program on your own mail server.
Right.
I'm found a. FAQ at Google. No, this is only for limit. You can only send to 500 recipients or less. But most email programs themselves limit you to 20 or between 20 and 50 recipients before
it's spam. Otherwise,
yeah, your local computer will stop sending it. We run into that a lot with Frontier. We've got like 2,000 people on our mailing list at the office, and when we try to send mail out, Frontier blocks our mail sending after the first 1,000.
Yeah.
In a day, you can only send 1,000 messages in a day, because then they think it's spam. Even though ours is an opt-in mailing list.
Yeah.
There should be a way so that the BCCs don't show on everyone's message, but I'm seeing a lot of stuff on the Google Groups discussion boards that it doesn't work like a BCC should. And there doesn't seem to be any reason they've listed before, and it just seems to be a bug in how Google Groups works.
Okay.
So there's nothing you can do. That's basically the answer.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Mac saying it's got a problem as opposed to that it's a feature?
This is a Google problem.
Okay.
You might want to switch over to Google Plus and put everyone in a plus circle. And then when you send a message to someone in the circle, people outside the circle don't see the message.
That would be a better idea.
Yeah, I'm not the administrator of the group, and I didn't set this up, but I told the administrator that I'd call you guys to see if you had an answer.
Yeah, look, from what I'm seeing inside of Google itself, the blind carbon copy is broken by Google, and there's nothing you can do to fix it. You have to wait until they fix it.
They probably won't, since they're phasing it out.
Yeah, it's not worth it. That's what I meant to say is Google, though. I mean, Google actually admitting that there's something wrong and don't, you know, call it like other places. Oh, it's a feature.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's just not going to, you know, it's going to give you issues because, no support and everything else. So, going to have to move on.
Yeah, move on to a different social network.
Okay.
Yeah, if any one of our other listeners has worked with Google Groups and knows a way to get around this,
feel free to call in.
Well, Google Plus, doesn't it have the Google Plus, because you can form circles.
Right, yes. Yeah, you opt into a Google Plus circle. Yeah.
Yeah, that might be, you know, I mean, since folks are familiar with Google and that type of stuff, look into Google Plus.
Okay, I'll suggest that to her.
Yeah, because that might, because you can control who can be in what circle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A little more control for you, and newer technology that if there is issues, you're going to get the support that you need.
Okay.
Whereas right now, you got something and you're limping along.
Yeah, we use it at my office. We use a program called Max Bulk Mailer from a company called Max Programming. And you send the mail yourself and you manage the mailing list yourself. So then you only have to worry about your ISP's email limits. And so that gives you more control over the type of messages, and the BCCing of the messages actually works on our list too. So that's something you could let the administrator of the list know, that they could use a different type of program to get that to work right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Let us know how you make out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Will do.
Yeah, it's always annoying when things don't work the way they're supposed to. I bet if they looked at the Google group on the Google Groups website, they wouldn't see all the recipients. But sent as an email, they apparently do.
They do.
So it's some interaction between the website and email interface. Remember, there used to be a big mess at AOL. If you tried to send an attachment across the AOL internet boundary, it would break and wouldn't work. Especially, yeah. And if you tried to attach multiple files to the single message, it would really break.
Yeah.
I still can't get over, though, the number of folks that still use AOL. Love the interface for AOL.
Yep. Well, and that's what they're used to.
It just takes me back to the old days. Remember when we used to get hundreds of discs to try out AOL? And then they started with the CDs, and everybody was on those. Here's a good one. Is CompuServe even still around?
Yeah, AOL owns them.
Yeah, they bought them.
CompuServe is big in Europe, where AOL was pretty much America only.
Because I go back to the days of CompuServe when it was strictly text.
Yep.
It was all text on a screen. In other words, you didn't have the GUI. It was just a screen that if you wanted to do this, this, and this, you press the number one. Number one took you to another menu that had choices there, and you could select that. It'd take you to another menu. Again, all text. No pictures, no bright colors. This was on a monochrome screen, green usually, or gold on a black background.
We did that. I did that with FidoNet. Before the internet in general made it to the mass public.
Yeah, I used to be a member of CompuServe, and when they went from a text base to the graphics, I said, you know what, for that and for what they're charging, I might as well just go to the internet. So that's what I did, and I dumped their service, and that's what everybody else did.
Mm-hmm. We used to joke about that. You get the free AOL disk and learn the way around while it's free, and then grow up and get a real internet service.
No.
Actually, I read something. I think it was an interview with Steve Case on like the 30th anniversary of AOL or something like that, and he was talking about all the CDs they used to send out, that they used the entire world's production of CDs in 1 month. Everybody that was making blank CDs, they bought them all to mail out.
Yeah.
How many millions or billions of CDs was that?
It was a lot.
Yep. A very lot.
Well, it's, same with the floppies.
Yep.
I was going to say, speaking of CDs, what's the best way to recycle those now? I was reading an article about...
a lot of shredders will chew them up.
Well, there's a company now that's trying to recycle them into making computer cases out of the plastic.
Melt the plastic down and...
Yeah.
Well, see, but you got to separate the different plastic layers and the different types of plastic. So it's one of those things where it's more expensive to recycle it than it is to just make a new one. But I'm doing a Google search here. I've seen a couple of companies that will take your CDs and recycle them. They're polycarbonate metals. The jewel cases themselves, you can easily just clean
reuse
and disinfect the jewel case and sell it again. Yeah,
yeah. Reuse the jewel cases, but the CDs or DVDs and that type of stuff.
Yep.
I say they've got shredders now that'll chew those on up.
Well, that's so nobody can get the information back,
right.
and then you melt it down and separate the different components out.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You ever seen the big shredders that will shred a car? Those are cool.
Oh, yeah.
Shred this.
They're scary.
Yeah. Does it shred? Yes, it shreds. All right, let's go to the news. Discover is partnering with Google and makes adding credit cards to the Google Wallet easier. Google Wallet, which is the company's near-field communication-based virtual wallet for Android, got a major update earlier this month when Google started giving its users the ability to use cards from Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover. On Thursday of last week, Google and Discover announced that they are now making it even easier for Discover customers to save their cards in Google Wallet. Discover now uses the Google Save to Wallet API to allow its card members to save their credit card directly to their wallet and debit their account from Discover's online center. This is the first time a major credit card company has been using this feature. Currently, users have to type their credit card number on their smartphone or into the Google Wallet website. With this tool, Google Discover users will just have to sign in to their regular credit card account, find the Google Wallet Add Your Card button, and then add their Google account. Discover then securely transmits all the information to the Google Wallet, and you're done. Discover is one of the smaller credit card companies in the U.S., but given that mobile payment systems and virtual wallets are still a bit of a novelty in the U.S., this will surely raise the overall awareness of mobile payment systems and allow a few new users to Google Wallet. Most users, after all, log on to their credit card accounts at least once a month to pay their bills, and if Google manages to partner with the major credit card issuers as well, this API could turn out to be quite a boon for Google Wallet. It's also good to see Google working directly with credit card companies. When Google added American Express to Google Wallet, American Express had never officially signed up. In today's announcement, Google also notes that since launching support for all major credit cards, it has seen a significant increase in sign-ups and app usage of people who have loaded the cards into their Google Wallet. Basically, what Google Wallet lets you do is pay for stuff using your smartphone. You may have seen some of those little card readers.
Square?
Well, no, not that. But when you're at a checkout counter, there's the swiper that you actually physically swipe your card. Hmm. Some of them also have a wave your card in front of the reader. A lot of newer credit cards...
Swipe and go.
Right. But some of the newer credit cards have an RFID chip in them. And so you don't have to physically swipe it. You just get it near. And a lot of smartphones... Well, not a lot now. It's only the Google Nexus right now has this near-field communication or NFC chip in it. So you wave your smartphone near the credit card scanner at the grocery market checkout, and it reads the either Google Wallet on the Android or iOS 6 now has a wallet feature coming as well. And you put your credit card in your electronic wallet, and you can pay electronically just by waving your phone over the sensor.
That kind of technology just kind of scares me.
Well, it's supposedly it's very short range, only 2 or 3 inches.
But
if you walk by a crowd of people, you might be able to suck their
wallet.
That's
right.
Yeah.
So it's got to be someone who's close enough to pick your pocket, so they can physically pick your pocket, or they can electronically pick your pocket at 2 to 3 inches.
Yeah, well, you go to New York City, about that close to you sometimes.
Yeah. One of the apps, though, that I was disappointed that doesn't work on my smartphone that well is they've got the one for the fobbles, the different keychain for Wegmans and CVS and Rite Aid.
Those are also things that you can put in electronic wallets.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, because right now the current programs that are out there for my smartphone don't work. Yep. I've tried using them at Wegmans. I think the one for Tops, that worked. They were able to read it off my smartphone because I can pull the program up and quick select the place I'm at. That way you don't have to have a keychain.
I've got
full.
So many of those.
Yeah, and so
they,
many
then they
of
break
those.
Off.
Yeah.
Now,
there's also, I've seen smartphone apps that will display coupons. And the theory is that the grocery store scans your smartphone and applies the coupon, so you don't have to physically have the coupon with you.
So is it a problem with the actual the program or the scanners in the stores?
The barcode scanners. We ran into this at our store, too, that Apple changed the size, position, and color of the barcodes on their computers. It used to be a nice black barcode on a white background. That was easy for the scanner to read.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Now it's a silver barcode on a silver background.
Oh, no.
And it's funny. We have to get a magnifying glass out and a flashlight to see the serial numbers on some of these newer computers.
Yeah.
Apple said, well, no problem. You just buy this new barcode scanner. That's $300.
No.
To read these really tiny barcodes. But yeah, so it's technology jumping up so that the scanners in the older cash registers may not be able to read the newer technologies. And it may be that specific app on that specific smartphone, they haven't called Wegmans yet.
Well, I think it's a good idea if you can to kind of wait until they work all the bugs out of the system before you jump in on this new technology.
You never
want to be on the bleeding edge of things, folks. You only have problems when
and
you
that's,
do that.
And that's kind of the catch-22, that if no one jumps into it, it never catches on.
Well, there's always going to be the leaders.
The early adopters,
That will do that. So I'm not that worried.
Yep. But and the other thing we're seeing now that they've mentioned is things like the Square Reader. Intuit has their own reader now that integrates in with QuickBooks, so it's great for small businesses. PayPal has a reader too. So now you're doing a garage sale or you have a PayPal business or something like that. You used to be limited to cash because it's very expensive
now
for people.
Now you can accept a credit card.
Yep. Now you can
Squared.
Take your credit card with Square on your smartphone or with the Intuit's Go payment or the PayPal thing. We like Square. Square was one of the first companies to come out with these credit card readers. Really, physically, a really small reader. In fact, I keep mine in its packaging because it's so small, I'm afraid to lose it.
Yeah.
But it makes on-site service. I can now get payment right at service. You don't have to say, we'll send you a bill, and you hope the check comes later.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always just keep mine in the car.
Yep.
And then that way it's handy with me.
It's always there waiting for you, yeah. Very easy to then it really helps with cash flow and payments. We've cut down on our accounts receivable because we can collect payment right then.
It is sweet.
I'll mail you a check next week, or the check went out last week. We better wait another week and we'll issue another check.
Mm-hmm.
I've been loving it because I prefer paying by credit card. Okay, pull out the phone, put that, and they look at me and I go, swipe it and put in the amount. There you go.
And what we even found,
we'll mail you a receipt.
Square's service fee is 2.75%. It's free to use the service. The dongle itself is the reader, credit card reader is free.
Yep.
It's a flat 2.75% for swiping. That's less than American Express charges us through our merchant terminal in the office. So we still use Square in our office when we have a merchant terminal right there too, because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one of Square's big ads. It's only 2.75%, even for Amex.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's the other thing, folks. I try to do it as a courtesy to a lot of smaller businesses that if I'm using my card, they'll say credit or debit. I'll say debit.
Debit, yeah.
It's a lower fee. And some folks are just too lazy, don't want to put in their PIN number and all that type of stuff. But here's the thing, folks. If you can go credit or debit, for the small business people and that type of stuff, do the debit. And I would say even for larger businesses, because it keeps costs down.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a merchant, when you come in and use your credit card, you have the reward program.
The reward ones are worse. Discover gives you 2% back. Discover takes the extra 2% from us.
Yeah.
They don't lose it themselves. They take it from us.
And
we got a 5% margin, and suddenly the credit card is taking 4.5%?
Mm-hmm.
That's horrible.
All right. Tell you what. We got to take a short break. We got kind of off on a tangent here, or I did. Texting with Nick there for a moment. He was... He's definitely out there listening. But you are listening to Member Supported Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright with Steve Ray and Rick. We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. And welcome back to this edition of Sound Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And, I forget what. CRS. Definitely CRS. Getting back into the work mode. What we were talking about. The Square and that. And the credit card charges and that. Yeah, it is a big issue. As a matter of fact, we had somebody say that, what was it, the Open Bank?
Yeah, he said something about
OpenBank.com, but we don't see it unless it's being blocked. But, I mean...
There was a My Open Bank. There were several Open Bank projects, but we didn't see anything called Open Bank itself.
Yeah.
In response to the first Niagara issue, that the pitchers, that there are several banking services that use pitchers as your second factor.
Right. Which is a cool thing. Some of them are even trying to go to the fingerprinting.
Yeah, have a fingerprint reader.
Yeah, have a fingerprint reader. You know, more and more.
News story there, too.
More and more. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, good segue.
But, and
I didn't even read.
Disney and Universal and a lot of the theme parks in Florida now are using fingerprints for multi-day passes so that you can't give, you buy a three-day pass and you can't give your extra day to somebody else. You have to use your fingerprint. But I talked about this on the Security Now podcast. What happens with those fingerprints? That now Disney has your fingerprint?
Yeah,
I think that's scary.
Do you trust Disney with your fingerprint? So one guy said he used his knuckle instead of his finger.
Yeah.
And then one guy didn't have fingers, and there was a problem there letting him in.
Ooh.
But, to the news story, Apple wants to put fingerprint sensors on some of its products. The next big feature could be a 2D fingerprint scanner.
Yeah, I read where they had just purchased some company
back in July, Apple licensed technology from a company called Authentic, with a capital T, to commercialize 2D fingerprint sensors for use on Apple products, according to a filing with the SEC. Apple said it's already agreed to buy this security technology provider for $356 million, but the deal needs shareholder approval. Apple has a history of acquiring companies for their technology. Siri, for example, was acquired, not developed internally. And Apple appears to be in a hurry. The company entered into a joint... development agreement in which Authentech would produce engineering work. The SEC filing, a proxy sent out to Authentech shareholders to approve the deal, spills some more interesting details. Representatives of Apple and Authentech. There's a Freudian slip.
Oh, no, Steve.
Oh, we got to capture that one.
We're
going
to be in trouble now.
Representatives of Apple and Authentech first met in February to talk about licensing the deal. The move, when talks were over, the deal had stalled, but Apple came back in May with an offer to buy the company out. to buy the company outright, making it clear that it would not be interested in an agreement. So this move to acquire Authentech suggests that Apple wants the technology for itself. A fingerprint sensor would be handy for large businesses or government agencies. Many other PC companies also have fingerprint sensors where you can log into your PC with a fingerprint. For consumers, it could be an attractive way to lock up Apple's forthcoming Passbook, which is a digital wallet that will be appearing in the next version of the iOS. So do you want a fingerprint sensor on your phone? Give us a call, 585-966-JAS, and see to see how you think about that.
Here's the other part that he forgot to put in, that he texted us. It's called Enterprise 2, the number 2, .openbank.com.
Ah, that would make all the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, Niagara. First Niagara customers log in with Enterprise 2, that's the number 2, .openbank.com.
Yeah, openbank.com has no anything.
Yeah, so you got to use the Enterprise.
Yep. Openbank.com does not exist, so I can't go to Enterprise2.openbank.com.
No, you're putting in Enterprise 2, the number 2, .openbank.com.
Right, and Google says openbank.com does not exist, so I can't go to any domain above openbank.com.
So you can't just even go up at the top of the webpage?
Nope. That's weird. But, fingerprint sensors, Mythbusters showed how easy it is to bypass fingerprint sensors, sometimes with just a photocopy of the fingerprint.
Yeah.
They went to some real great lengths about, lifting a fingerprint with tape and putting the oil down, the fingerprint powder down and building a fingerprint and printing it on a micrograph. Mm-hmm. And then they said, well, just take a photocopy and see what happens. And
sometimes it works.
A casual fingerprint sensor worked, yep. So... I don't know about having fingerprints as a security
feature.
Yeah. And the more fingerprints that are out there, the worse it could be to security.
And a bigger database to scan. Yep.
There was a couple of episodes of the Las Vegas version of what was the crime show that was
CSI?
So popular? CSI, yeah. Where this guy kept getting arrested for crimes he didn't commit because he worked at a prop house and he made a mold of his hand as a prop. And the bad guys were using this mold of his hand with his fingerprints to break into places, leaving his fingerprints behind. So, like, the first couple episodes, it was over a season or two, they kept showing up, no, it wasn't me, it's the hand. And then the guy really committed a crime and tried to blame it on the prop again, too. But no, this one really was him.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Gerd, our friend Gerd. Go ahead, Gerd.
Hello. This is a convoluted kind of a story. I got my wife a ThinkPad SL500, which was XP.
Turn your radio down, please. We can hear it in the background.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God. There, it's off.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is the second time that something happened major, and I just cleaned it clean and started from scratch with CDs. And the last time I did it, which was yesterday, lo and behold, I now have Vista on the machine. And it works. Everything's cool. But can I upgrade that to Windows 7, even though it's like 4 years old?
Probably.
I would say probably not.
Yeah. I mean, 7 takes a little more horsepower.
Yeah, and that was going to be the rest of my statement. Probably, but you probably don't want to.
Yeah.
You can go to Microsoft's Windows 7 website, and I'm trying to post the link here. They still have a compatibility checker
Don't they, like they did for Vista?
If anything, I'd go back to XP before going to Vista. XP was better than Vista, and I wouldn't go jump up to 7 only because it requires so much more resources. And yeah, it might not be able because it's an older machine.
You want at least 4 gigs of RAM. You want at least a dual-core processor. Mm-hmm. You want at least, 512
graphics.
Video. Yeah, 512 dedicated video card. So if the machine has that, you might be happy with 7, but it may be too old.
How do I go back to XP?
Put your XP disks back in and reinstall it.
Well, yeah. If I knew where they were, I would do that.
Yeah.
Well, then you're stuck with Vista.
I don't know what happened. I just looked at disk 1, disk 2, disk 3, let them run, and lo and behold, the machine now has Vista.
Oh, I bet what happened.
The original.
Well, that may have been a time when you could put XP or Vista on the machine.
Yep.
And it came with both. It may and so you may be able to put your disk 1 back in, and you may have missed a step that said which OS do you want to install.
Oh, okay.
Does the computer have a label on it that says XP or Vista, or
no?
Would it have both?
The sticker on the bottom, was it Vista or XP?
Well, I'm out in the porch in the living room.
Yeah, the license code sticker on the computer should tell you what the original OS was.
Because, if it's something else, what they'll do is they'll sell you the license, but you could they offered what they called a downgrade.
Oh, yeah, it might even have gone backwards. It came with Vista, you could downgrade it to XP.
Yeah, because a lot of folks couldn't have Vista on their machines because depending on where they were doing it, so they offered what they called a downgrade. And it was the same price, but you got a Vista license, but they would downgrade you to XP, even though XP was actually an upgrade instead of Vista.
Yep. And I've posted a link for the Windows 7 Upgrade Advisor.
Okay.
It's a program you download and run on your computer. It will tell you if you can upgrade to 7. I'm trying to see the detailed specs on it, because just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should.
So but, I'm better off than going back to XP.
If you can get it, yeah.
Yeah, if you can find it on that original disk.
Make sure you back everything up first before you do it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, no, I cleaned the whole hard drive. I mean, it really didn't make any difference.
Oh, okay, yeah, so it's a clean install, so hey, go for it. Give it a shot.
How do I get back to XP?
Put your original XP disks in and reinstall them.
Okay.
And if your computer was one that came with both Vista and XP, you need to make sure you've checked that box when you're installing them.
And you're going to have to also, once you get it, most of them will probably be, if it's only 5 years, Service Pack 2, which means then once you get Service Pack 2, then you're going to have to go hunting for Service Pack 3 to get the latest updates to keep that machine somewhat secure.
I think Service Pack 3 is still downloadable.
Yes. Yep.
So far.
As far as I know, yeah, it's one thing that, again, it's one of those things that the time is ticking away at that. Because Windows 8 is coming out I believe October is the time frame now.
Is it worth going up there to 8?
I wouldn't.
Wait till you get
a new machine.
Yeah, wait till you get a new machine.
I wouldn't go to Windows 8 right now unless, if they were giving it away, only because if they gave me the free tablet to go along with it.
Yeah, it's more of a tablet OS than it is a desktop OS.
It is totally a tablet. And I said a while ago, if you've been listening to the show, you know how much I just loved Windows ME.
I listen to it every week.
And you know what? Windows 8 is going to be the same thing. In fact, I even quizzed Nick. I said, Nick, what's the chances of RIT in your area, College of Business, switching over to Windows 8? Not too soon.
Yeah.
Because it is going to be a major paradigm shift in the way you do Windows.
Okay.
Because the taskbar that you were since Windows 3.1 that you're used to, clicking on the start button and going from here to going there, that's gone.
Okay.
There is none. You got to put these different, like apps on multiple screens and getting around, it'll take you quite a while just to learn it. And if you're in a business and trying to be productive, you're going to have to sit there and go through retraining, and it's going to be a nightmare.
You're going to be scratching your head for quite a while.
Yeah.
Well, Vista is a strange little program also, just looking at it.
Yeah, that was a radical departure from the way XP worked, and that was one of the main reasons nobody liked it, because it was too different. So now they're doing the same thing between 7 and 8. Is 8 is radically different than 7, and most of us are expecting 8 to be a failure.
Yeah, okay. Well, I appreciate the help.
Sure. You're quite welcome, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Have a good one.
Yeah. And thanks for calling.
That actually segues into another news story, that the one way that Windows 8 could be a success is if the Microsoft Surface tablet becomes a success. And Microsoft reportedly doesn't care if its $199 Surface tablet pushes partners out of the market. Microsoft is reportedly well aware that pricing its entry-level Windows RT tablet at $199 will push its vendor partners out of the market, but it might launch the device anyway. Microsoft hardware partners are very worried about the possibility of a $199 tablet. Unless Microsoft only sells the device in the U.S., partners like Asus, Lenovo, Samsung, and Dell may stop producing Windows tablets since they won't be able to compete at that price. According to the report, Microsoft knows very well that it is angering its partners, but doesn't seem to care. The source pointed out that Microsoft is fully aware that its actions have greatly offended notebook clients, and therefore trying to achieve success requires at least a 30% share of the tablet PC market, but a price of $199 is expected to allow the company to reach its goal. Microsoft will release Windows RT, which no one's quite sure what the RT means, but that's the tablet version. It's not called Windows 8 tablet. It's called Windows RT now. The Windows 8 Surface tablets on October 26th, the same day it ships Windows 8 desktop, laptop, and tablets from Microsoft partners. So would you buy a Microsoft Surface tablet for $200? Or would you buy an Amazon Kindle Fire for $200? Or a Nook e-reader, e-tablet for
$200? Go with the Google. I'm loving the Google Nexus.
Yeah, the Google Nexus
mine
for $200.
Yeah, I got mine with the 8 gig, and I've got quite a bit loaded onto it, and I still have over 5 gig still free.
So much stuff is in the cloud, you don't need much local storage anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got a couple books on there, you know, one that I'm reading, it's over a 600-page book, and a couple others. And like I say, I have made a dent, and the thing is fast. It comes with a gig of memory. And, 8 gig of storage and a quad-core processor, it just flies.
Yep.
It's unbelievable.
So all these competing $200 tablets, is going to, that's the problem the PC world has had for years, is you've got so many companies making so many computers at such a similar price. You know, even HP, they have, 57 different laptops?
Yep.
Yeah, how do you keep
$20
them
$20 apart.
Yep. All right, tell you what. We got to take a short break here, but we will be back. I've got somebody calling on the phone right now. I'll get to them in just a moment. But you are listening to member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
And I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rick Harrison.
And we have, and I usually like to go, Joe from Buffalo, but it's actually Joe from, and I'll do it legal this time for you, Joe. Joe from Cheektowaga.
Oh.
I still like Joe from Buffalo.
Microsoft seems to be doing that TikTok thing, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, every other OS has been crap. Yep.
Well, let's hope we don't get something like Android with that. But not a whole lot of people seem to like Honeycomb.
Well, the reason I'm saying that Microsoft is, they could solve this issue very easily, is when you get your new Windows 8 system, you're given a choice that you can flop back and forth to the new look of Windows or the old look.
Yeah, being able to get back to the start menu and get away from that Metro interface.
Yeah. If they were to do that, I think it would meet, because then if I could switch, I could, slowly go back and forth and work my way around it and learn things at my own pace.
One of the things that I've read on a couple of the blogs is that If you run a regular program under Windows 8, you'll see the desktop and you'll see the old-style interfaces. But as soon as they upgrade to the Windows 8 Metro, then you'll only see the Metro stuff. So on the consumer release and developer pre-releases that are out now that you can download, it's disjointed. You're switching back and forth between this Metro app when you're doing the Microsoft stuff,
yep,
and then the old style desktops when you're doing regular apps.
And here's the other thing that they're going to also shoot themselves with, Joe, is Microsoft is now starting up their own app store. So you know they're going to have apps to do this, apps to do that. And I'm sorry, Microsoft has a track record that goes years and years of doing something. And it's say like Microsoft Money, if everybody remembers that program. And it was one that was going to compete with Quicken.
And they bought that from somebody and then killed it.
And not many folks were using it, so we're no longer supporting. It's gone. Goodbye. So all those poor people that did switch were stuck because here's the other twist, and this is one that really gets me. Converting your information to get it, say, over to QuickBooks or Quicken or some other program, didn't happen. So folks had to get
locked in.
Yes, you were locked in. You weren't going anywhere. They had you, and forget it. And like I say, they just turned around, dropped support, and you were left holding the bag and had to go find something else and re-enter, say, all your memorized transactions and balances and all this other stuff.
I think I remember reading some commercial services did come out to convert your money for you, but they were probably doing it manually and then could charge you for the time and labor.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't hold a lot of good hopes for Windows 8. I'm sorry.
Well, I also read a story on the web that they're just like XP was formerly known as Longhorn, they're dropping the Metro name too, and the leaked new name is Modern UI, which always gets me. It's like NT, new technology, yet new for when.
good one.
You know, extended when, enhanced, you know, it's like EVGA, enhanced video graphics array.
The click words.
From the last version, yep.
Yep. No one improved.
The other story that's been hitting the web is that third-party developers cannot use the word Metro in their name either. So a developer who updates his app to take advantage of the newest systems can't use the name that says they've taken advantage of the newest system.
like Twitter client Metro or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, they cannot use the word Metro in their programs. Microsoft themselves are facing a trademark claim over someone else who already has the word Metro trademarked.
Yep.
I'm on Anantech. Let me see if I can figure out
crazy folks.
That original that may be why they're not using the word Metro anymore. Oh, yeah, the company called Metro AG has accused Microsoft of infringing on their trademark on the word Metro. So maybe that's why Microsoft has stopped using it, because they lost that suit. So now it's Windows 8 style user interface is the new terminology they're using. Metro was a code name. Yeah. There it is.
Yeah.
Sure.
Just a code name.
Yeah, and I got some swampland for you.
I'll also agree that's a really good idea to use Google Plus for group discussion. There's nothing that forces you to get a message from them. You actually have to put somebody in a circle before you start getting notifications that there's messages up there. And it seems to me to be fairly secure. I mean, still, you got to be careful of, you know, it is a public company there, and it's a free service. There's no guarantees or anything like that about what you post up there.
Yep.
So, you know, take that with a grain of salt.
And those,
but you were saying, you know, locked in? Google has their data takeout while they're actually send you a zip of, like, all your postings from your blog or all your postings from Google+.
Yeah, they call it data liberation. It's the data liberation front where you can export all of your data from any of Google services anytime you want. So you're not locked into Google. Yeah.
You can basically make regular backups if you like.
Yep.
I'd also say another good service of Google is Google Voice. You were talking before about how you don't like to get text messages. Well, that's actually what I was doing. I was using Google Voice to send you text messages before about First Niagara. And the thing about that is you can forward text messages to an email address, so you don't pay anything for them. They'll forward your email address. If you want to send them from your phone, you can use it, or you can, if you want, you can send them to your phone and you can reply, and your Google Voice number will show.
Yep.
That's who it comes from.
And if you have a home phone, a business phone, a cell phone, you might have a couple of different business lines, you can give out your Google Voice number, and Google Voice will ring all of those phones for you. So whatever phone you happen to be near, you can answer a call coming into your Google Voice number.
And if they're inbound calls, you can press asterisk, and it will start ringing your phones again. So you can actually conference with another one of your phones or effectively do a transfer.
Yep. And it's currently a free service. It's really nice, yeah.
I just hate it if they don't make it a free service for next year too. But you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it was when they announced it last year. They said free through the end of the year. Well, at near the end of the year, they said, okay, it's going to be free next year too. So hopefully it'll be free next year too.
Yeah, I always kind of have a difficult time sometimes when they do that. It's like, do I really want to become involved and invested in this if, you know, later on down the pike they're going to put the screws to me?
Well, yeah, that's the trick, that when you get used to something, you don't want to give it up. So if they suddenly charge you, although, you know, being Google, I could see it being no more than a couple of bucks a month.
Yeah.
Well, look, they're going to...
Yep.
But one of the other articles,
only like a couple cents a minute, or a cent a minute, or something like that.
Yeah,
that's actually what VoIP service wholesales for commonly is, a cent or two a minute.
Well, I just think it's more honest if you say up front, hey, you know, we have to charge something for this service, and here's what it is.
They very well, though, might not, because just last week, though, we had an article, or Nick was reading an article on how Google wants to bring fiber in. And what is it? They started
in Kansas City, and they're
giving it out free.
Five megabit for free.
So, I mean, you know, if they're going to do that, and again, if you're going to use their services, it's just that many more folks, and they can sell that much more advertising and everything else. It's a win for Google.
Well, that's fine, as long as, you know, that's the model that they put out there, and they kind of stick with that model. You know, I disagree when... they do the bait and switch thing.
Oh yes, nobody likes that.
Maybe they could do a program, something like Magic Jack. Magic Jack only charges like $20 a year.
Yep.
And what they end up doing is selling your calling patterns to interested companies.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they make it so cheap.
Yeah, we use.
I haven't explored NetTalk yet, but that's another service. That's $30 a year, and I wonder how they make that so cheap.
Yeah, we've used Magic Jack in our office. We were able to shut down our $100 a month business phone line and went to Magic Jack at $20 a year, which is amazing.
That can be nice.
We've run into some static a little bit on the internet because it's making an internet call. But
technical problems. Occasionally it'll shut down.
You get technical static on your regular phone sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot.
Go ahead.
Oops, sorry, I didn't mean to cut him off. He sounded like he was starting another thought there.
Yeah.
I thought we were done. Sorry, Joe.
Well, it's just, we got
to... We're getting close to the end.
Yeah, we're getting close up to the end anyways. But, Joe, if you still have, further questions or discuss that, give us a call again next week. And thank you, I thought it was him telling us about that open bank.
I don't know why I can't get in. It may be because we're at the school here.
Yeah,
but
they might just be blocking, and that's not to say that it's wrong. I mean, other folks can do, you know, check it out, but
I'm coming up with a DNS error, not a blocked by the proxy server error.
Oh, okay.
Which is weird.
Yeah, it's totally different, and you know, who knows? I mean, like I say, we try our best to get to some of the sites and check stuff out for folks, but we can't always do it because we are under the school systems, umbrella. And that kind of tells me, folks, that, as Nick would say, you've literally wasted for no unanswerable reason another 2 hours of your life listening to sound bites. We do appreciate all the folks that did call and taking the time. If you do have a question, please save it and call us again next week. We will be here. Nick will be back on the longest running computer show in the known universe. You are listening to Sound Bites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1. And the Great German Show with George coming up, and Linda hopefully will keep him in line.